This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Locally, it's 297-5633, and you can send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org if you're so inclined. Later in the show, we'll visit with Jeffrey Marks, the Pulitzer Prize-winning sports writer, and he is a close friend of Alex Bregman, who's the toast of Houston in the baseball world. His Astros won the World Series in 7 games over the Los Angeles Dodgers. And speaking of sports, it was 47 years ago today that perhaps the most famous play in New Orleans Saints history occurred at the old Tulane Stadium. The Saints were in their 4th season. They were having a tough year. J.D. Roberts was coaching his first game after the original coach Tom Fears had been fired. And the Saints were down 17-16, had the ball in Detroit, actually in their own on their own side of the field, because in those days the goalposts were right at the goal line on each side. So Tom Dempsey lines up for a 63-yard field goal attempt. At that time, the all-time record in the NFL was 56 yards. And here's Al Wester with the call, November 8th, 1970, Tulane Stadium. The Detroit Lions 17, the Saints 16, with Tom Dempsey trying to win it.
Will it try to kick the longest field goal in National League history? They're sending him on with 2 seconds left. Scarpetti will hold. Here's a snap. The ball is down. Dempsey kicks. It's on the way. It is.
And the Saints, who won 3 games their first year, 4 their second, 5 their third, had won their second game of the 1970 season. So doing the math, just their 14th win in history. But that one remains perhaps the most memorable, other than the Super Bowl victory on February 7th of 2010. But Al Wester made the call 47 years ago today. Tom Dempsey, the late Tom Dempsey, who was born with half a right foot and no right hand, kicked a then record that has since been broken by 1 yard, a 63-yard field goal. With us to begin our conversation in studio is Stanley Wilder. He is the dean of the LSU Libraries. He has degrees from the University of Wisconsin in his hometown of Madison, Columbia University, New York, and the University of Illinois, Chicago. And he's been in charge of the libraries at the old War School for the last 4 years. And good morning to you.
Thank you.
Stanley Wilder, if you can get a little closer, that would be good.
Pleasure to be here.
And it's a pleasure to have you in studio. Thank you for joining us. And right now there's a lot of conjecture about the future of the Middleton Library, which has been part of the quadrangle for a long time and obviously is not what it used to be. There are some issues, but let's start with that. How significant are the issues as far as the disrepair that is evident there?
You know, we have issues with Middleton Library, and I think that those have been reported on pretty thoroughly over the course of the past year or so. There's a message that hasn't come out in the midst of all of this, and that is the really serious investments that LSU is making in Middleton Library to make it better. And so, for example, right now we've got a major basement waterproofing project going on. We have a brand new meditation and prayer space. We're buying new furniture and creating additional study space because we have the highest use academic building on campus, and so there's always pressure to accommodate more students.
Mm-hmm. How serious is the discussion about tearing it down and building a new one?
You know, I think that those discussions are serious because the campus master plan, which has just been presented and approved, is available on LSU's website. Does call for Middleton Library to move to a new location, a new building, in such a way as to restore the quadrangle to its original cruciform shape. That's where those that idea comes from. It's from the recent LSU master plan.
877-217-5757 if you'd like to talk to Stanley Wilder. Those of us who went to LSU, as I did in the late 70s, early 80s, we spent a lot of time at Middleton. There's still, what, about 5 million books there, aren't there?
Yeah, we're very proud of the collections that we have here. The collections that LSU has place it among the most elite universities in the country. So yeah, in terms of just the number of books that we've got, collections were elite, but really the crown jewel of the LSU libraries is its extraordinary special collections, which are internationally famous. I really think it's just not possible to do research in certain kinds of Southern and Louisiana history, Civil War history, plantation history, without coming to LSU and using those collections.
How does the, and this is a question from a listener, how does the Middleton Library dovetail with the Hill Memorial Library?
Well, that's pretty easy. The Hill Memorial houses our special collections, which means manuscript, rare book, and archives, things that don't generally leave the building. So we do plenty of teaching and outreach from that Hill Memorial Library building, but it's all in terms of unique and rare materials that are just too precious to be sitting on stacks with out in the open.
Well, the library, we've seen the photos, and you say things are being done to help it, and some are making the note that here we have this new $85 million recreation center across campus, and the library could have used some of that money to spruce things up. Supposedly the money comes from two different pools. The rec center was built from student fees, but what about student fees possibly restoring the Middleton Library to its former glory?
Yeah, you know, I don't know anything about what kind of sources of funding might be dedicated to renovations or new library buildings. So the most I can say about this is the part that I'm connected to, mm-hmm. is that we know that fundraising will be an important part of whatever we do going forward. Mm-hmm. Not the only part, but an important part.
Now, as a former student, I still go to the Middleton Library. Usually I just look things up, don't check anything out, but is it accessible to people who are not affiliated with the university? If they wanted to check out a book, could they do it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the library we're part of a public university, and we take that public identity very seriously in such a way that the building is open to anyone who wishes to use it, except in the wee hours of the night where we have a security concern. But another thing that we do that lots of people know about is that any citizen of the state of Louisiana can check out books using only their driver's license or some kind of ID. So not only can you come and visit, but you can actually circulate material from the library.
And I noted the other day there's this magnificent structure in Baton Rouge at Goodwood, the city library. And there are other branches that are, some of them are quite impressive. And there's another one going up downtown. There's the state library downtown. How many libraries do we need? Can we always have another good one?
Well, I'll tell you what, the from my point of view, these are apples and oranges. The function of an academic library is to support research and teaching, and so there's really very little overlap between what the LSU libraries does and what the public library does. Mm-hmm. So you know, we just can't speak in terms of there being too many. The public library, and they would say this if they were here, they can't support the kinds of advanced scientific and engineering, mm-hmm. research, for example, that the libraries does.
So if I wanted to go to LSU and find something there that I could not access other places, what are some examples?
Well, you know, the so Let's say that we're talking about Louisiana newspapers. This is a project that goes back decades that LSU Libraries has spearheaded for the state, which is to digitize microfilm, preserve and make available to people newspapers from all over the state. And so we're quickly digitizing these and making them available in such a way that people are able to search and use them from anywhere. So this is just an example of the kind of thing that a research library can do that you wouldn't expect elsewhere.
Are you optimistic about the future?
Oh yeah, yeah. This is such a great time to be a librarian and engaged in the kind of work that we do. It's really seriously the case that we've never been more successful. Libraries have never been more successful than they are right now in terms of their impact.
877-217-5757 is your number. We'll spend some more time with Stanley Wilder, Dean of the LSU Libraries. And then we'll hear from Jeffrey Marks, the decorated sports writer who lives right here in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Ali Baltazar is producing. Your numbers 297-5633 locally and outside of Baton Rouge, 877-217-5757. Our email is talk@talklouisiana.org. Stanley Wilder is with us. He's the dean of the LSU Libraries, which means he's not only the dean of Middleton, but also of Hill Memorial. Now, Hill is, of course, an amazing structure with an immense history. You can see a nice oil painting of William Tecumseh Sherman in
That's
there,
right.
the founder of LSU, the guy who was the leader of the Union Army in the Civil War. And ironically... maybe not ironically, appropriately, the LSU Library is named after a great World War II general, Troy Middleton, who was
That's
president
right.
of the university. And some say that it's not the most beautiful structure, that it doesn't fit in well with the other architecture in the quadrangle. How do you answer those critics, Stanley?
Oh, sure. You know, we located a pamphlet that was created at the time of Middleton's opening in 1959, and this pamphlet is just beautiful from the standpoint that it just exudes the pride and innovation that Middleton Library represented back then. And I think it's important to remember that for the time that it was built, it really was an innovative, exciting place with lots of new features, and that the campus was proud of it. And so this is really the thing that I'd like to sort of carry forward, is that we could have that again, and we're going to need to do that again in order for LSU to be the great university that it aspires to be.
How does the university compare right now with, say, other Southeastern Conference universities when it comes to the condition and the stature of the library?
You know, we compare well with our SEC peers in terms of the size of collections and expenditures. So I think that we do a good job there, and that's something to be proud of. We have room for mm-hmm. improvement. There's no question.
Okay, a listener asks if the library is moved for construction, where would it go on a temporary basis?
You know, I think that if that were to if we build a new library building, then we are going to have time to see to it that there is no temporary location. Actually, temporary locations are just unfeasible given collection size that we have.
Yeah. Well, another listener notes that if you got 5 million books, that'd be quite a move. And now with everything digitized, why do you need 5 million books?
Why do you need 5 million? We're talking about a research institution in such a way that the size and depth and scope of the collections mm-hmm. that we have here are absolutely instrumental to the kind of research and teaching. People come to LSU because we have resources like this in such a way that this is a treasure. This is a mm-hmm. this is a thing that really sets us apart. So we need those 5 million books. They help make us who we are, and they provides for us a foundation for the books that we still need to buy, mm-hmm. because they're still relevant.
Well, if somebody were to come to town and they were doing research, say, on Huey Long, they want to know about Huey Long, should they go to the State Library? Should they go to Middleton? Should they go to Hill? Should they go to all of them?
You know, I think that the governor's papers are by law in Louisiana sent to the state archives, and so that's an important place for Huey Long material. But Hill Library has very significant Huey Long documentation. We actually have terrific documentation on all of the Longs, Senator Long and the Long family. So photographs and archives, letters, and so on. I think that person coming to Baton Rouge would have to come to Hill, too.
Well, Hill goes back how long? Before Huey, right?
Yeah. I should know the date that building was built, but it would be the...
It's one of the oldest buildings on campus.
On campus, yeah, absolutely. 20s.
Yeah, and of course Huey was killed in 1935, but
yeah.
He wanted LSU to have the best of everything.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he would want them to have the best library.
Yeah, that's right. We want the best for Louisiana students and citizens. So that's, you know, we carry that forward every day.
Well, and you came here from another place. You've been to a lot of libraries. You were at Columbia University in New York. I realize this is apples and oranges, but if we were to compare the LSU library system with what you had at Columbia, an Ivy League school, how would it rate?
Oh, how would it rate? I think that the basic difference here is really the mission of the institutions. Columbia is a private institution that based in New York City, and whereas LSU is a public land grant institution with an entirely different mission. So the issue of access is terribly important. The issue of connection to Louisiana economic issues like agriculture and, mm-hmm. and petrochemical industry and so on, all of those things really make LSU and Columbia apples and oranges.
Well, I appreciate your passion, and thanks for coming in today, and hopefully there will be great things to come for a system that has a great history.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Stanley Wilder, Dean of the LSU Libraries, and we're joined now in studio by Jeffrey Marks, the Pulitzer Prize-winning sports writer who, like Stanley, came here from another place, and you've stayed a while, Jeffrey.
I have, and Stanley, great to meet you, and I love hearing the New York reference.
Okay. We may have some problems with your microphone, so let's see if we can... Allie, let's go to the plan B here. Just hold it for now, and we'll we'll get by. But we mentioned you came here from another state, and you've worked in several states. But you've been in how long in Baton Rouge now, Jeffrey?
Wow, I'm not real good at math. I want to say it's coming up on 11 years, which is shocking to me. But I've loved every minute of it. It's been wonderful.
11 years, and what was the catalyst to get you here?
Only one. My great wife, Leslie, from Thibodaux, Louisiana. So I grew up in New York, went to school in Chicago, most of my adult years in Washington, D.C., and then I had the good fortune. I've been told I'm geographically challenged, but I finally made my way here. So it's all worked out really well, and this is my adopted homeland, and I love it.
Well, was it a story that you covered that got you here first?
No, initially in the 1990s, I want to say the 93-94 basketball season, I came here and spent most of that season with Dale Brown when he was coaching LSU basketball. And it was during that time period when I was here that I met Leslie. And then that led to much more important mm-hmm. things in my life than hanging out with Dale in a gymnasium. So.
Well, and Dale had this amazing career, but by 1994, that's when things started going the wrong direction for him.
Well, that was a tough season. For those who remember, a guy named Randy Livingston was a wonderful basketball player, player of the year in Louisiana and in high school, and great things were expected of him at LSU, but that was the year he hurt his knee. And so things went kind of south there for a little bit for the basketball Tigers.
Mm-hmm. And you have a history with another LSU luminary in Bertram Hayes Jones, the most valuable player in the NFL, 1976. You were with him at a young age.
Well, yeah, in a special way for me as an 11-year-old boy, I became a ball boy for the Baltimore Colts football team when there was such a football team in the NFL.
Yeah.
And at that time, Burt was their star quarterback. So he's been very special to me my whole life. We've been very good friends, and his family and my family, and it's just a wonderful relationship, a guy I have a lot of love for.
Yeah, over 40 years, and it started when you were a kid.
Yeah, that was a lot of hairs and a lot of years ago.
And some good seasons with the Colts when you were there. They made the playoffs. I saw a photo recently when the Colts won the 1975 divisional title, beating Miami. Bert was hugging a kid on the sidelines. Was that you?
If it is, I'd love to see that photo.
Tony
Linhart made
in the
kick.
Fog, yeah.
No. I have to believe if there were a photo that important to my childhood, I would somehow have it. So no, I don't think so.
And then you, as fate would have it, became friends with Tony Linhart's son, who played football at LSU.
Right. Well, Bernd was just a tiny little boy when I got to know him. Tony Linhart, another player on that team from Vienna, Austria, started out as a professional soccer player, came to the United States as a kicker in the NFL. But yeah, Bernd is a kid that I watched grow up and went to LSU as a walk-on.
And Jeffrey's close friends with Alex Bregman, the third baseman for the world champion Houston Astros. We'll talk about Alex Bregman and more when we return after the news with Karen Henderson on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757 is your number. And Jeffrey Marks is with us, the Pulitzer Prize-winning sports writer. He won it as a beat writer with the Lexington Herald Leader many years ago when he was, 23 years old, I think. He is a little older than that now, the author of 6 books, the last Walking with Tigers. He is now a huge LSU fan. And it is an amazing transformation, Jeff, that you're this great writer and an excellent journalist, but you are a fan. I think it's fair to say you bleed purple and gold now, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. It's been such a big part of my time here in Louisiana. I've enjoyed it so much. When I moved here, I've been around sports my whole life, and so I naturally was going to gravitate toward the world of LSU sports. I already had a couple connections to it, as you mentioned, because of the time I'd spent with Dale Brown and earlier, Burt Jones. Burt being the first person from the state of Louisiana I ever met in my life. So, I already had a liking for the LSU Tigers, mm-hmm. but moving here made it all very different. And then I never expected really to write about any of that, but I'm really glad I did. I'm really glad I had mm-hmm. that opportunity.
And you developed a friendship with Alex Bregman when he was at LSU, and he was one of the greatest players in the history of the Old War School, and quite likely will be one of the greatest, maybe the greatest player to ever play in the majors for LSU. LSU has no baseball Hall of Famers, but Alex is off to a good start.
He's off to a wonderful start. He's a special young guy. Alex is one of 3 baseball players that I featured in that book. The book is a collection of stories from all different sports, but 3 of the people featured baseball, Rafe Rimes, Mikey Matuk, and Alex Bregman. It's kind of funny looking back on it now because when I started working on that story with Alex, it was actually scheduled to be one of the shorter pieces in the book. It ended up being the longest of the 21 chapters. Not that you judge a story by the length, but it just says something about the attachment to Alex and to his family. I got to know his parents very well. They came in a lot from New Mexico as well. And just his journey, his mm-hmm. backstory, and everything about this young man's makeup was very appealing to me as a writer and also as a friend.
How did he end up at LSU from Albuquerque?
LSU baseball program being so strong. He was drafted out of high school. He would have been drafted a lot higher in the first round. He would have been drafted had he not been hurt his senior year in high school. So because of that, he had the option of either coming mm-hmm. to LSU where, he wanted to come to school here and be a baseball player here because of the program that Paul Mainieri runs. But certainly if he had been drafted in the first round where he would have been and gotten the kind of offer that he would have gotten, I'm fairly certain he would have ended up straight into professional baseball.
And he played 3 years, and 2 of those with Aaron Nola, who arguably is the best pitcher to ever be produced by LSU. But they didn't win a national championship. That has to be somewhat of a disappointment for both of them.
Oh, absolutely. But they have a lot of great memories to look back on, and a lot of people don't understand or wouldn't have known this at the time. Aside from the baseball field, mm-hmm. Alex Bregman and Aaron Nola were actually roommates for their sophomore – well, it would have been Bregman's sophomore year – and, boy, you talk about some funny stories that came out of that mm-hmm. place. And it's one of the things that I really enjoyed working on that piece was A lot of what I write about has nothing to do with the games or the mm-hmm. points on the scoreboard. It's really about these people and their lives and their journeys. And that's why working with Alex and Aaron Nola was a big part of that, working on that chapter as well. Really two great young guys and both doing so well now in the major
both
leagues.
Both of them, yes. But Bregman, he's a world champion. He had an excellent postseason. One point there was talk if he had big games in game 6 or 7 and 7, he would have been the MVP. But still, a great postseason, excellent regular season, 19 homers, 39 doubles, and good third baseman. And he's on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, man, what hasn't he been on the last few days? It's been really funny keeping up with him since the World Series and tracking some of his movements. And we had a chance to talk over the weekend, and he was sharing with me some of the fun things that have happened along the way. And just watching him grow, I mean, that's what's been so enjoyable for me. He was this kid when he came here. Of course, he was a college student. But, you know, Alex has grown in so many ways, not just on the field, but off the field as well. He has such an incredible heart. We all know what Alex can do on the baseball field, but spending the time that I did with him away from the field and seeing him interact with people and knowing him the way I do and his family, just knowing that he's really at his all-time best when he's away from the field and seeing him shine and the happiness when he's touching the lives of others, that's what I see in him the most. I see the way he is with kids. I see the way he's going to impact the lives of young people for a long time to come.
All right. Allison asks if he's living in Baton Rouge in the offseason.
No, he's not, but he'll certainly be here some, and starting with this weekend, he'll be here for the LSU football game. So I know he's pretty pumped about that.
LSU, Arkansas, and the Bengal Bells, who you also wrote about in your book, Walking with Tigers, they have a huge event honoring the seniors this, I think it's Friday, at the River Center.
Right.
And there's some talk that Alex Bregman may be there. But
there is, and I think that's still a little iffy at this point. I don't know that that's 100% confirmed, but I hope it is. I hope it works out. Mm-hmm. It'll depend on his schedule, but boy, that would be his second parade. They do a parade in there for senior day. He'd be in a parade again. I don't know that it would be exactly like the one they just had in Houston, but I know it would be a lot of fun for mm-hmm. him, and also for the LSU fans. It'll be at the Bengal Bells. It's such a great organization. I really enjoyed getting to know them when I was working on the book mm-hmm. as well.
How often do you see Bregman?
During the season, a couple times. I went, fortunately, right before the flood. I was there for a few days watching him play and working on a couple things with him and his hitting coach, Jason Columbus, who's also an LSU, former mm-hmm. LSU baseball player, and so close with Alex. So, you know, we get that chance. Next season, I'm hoping with a little less on my schedule and still the same 162 games on his schedule, I'm hoping to do a little more traveling with Leslie. Leslie's really come to enjoy the baseball as well, and we'll go to a few away games. We've been going mm-hmm. to the ones in Houston, but I'd like to go. It'd be fun to see him on a couple of his road trips as well.
All right, and if there's a book about Alex Bregman, Jeffrey's the guy to do it, Jeffrey Marks. A listener, Casey, notes that you were on this show several years ago with Carl Lewis, right in this studio. How's Carl doing?
Carl's doing great. And, boy, that's another neat thing about this journey is Carl lives in Houston, as you know, and I've had the opportunity to introduce Bregman and Carl. And they've actually a few times now, the three of us spent some time together. And so it's really kind of neat to be able to see for me, because relationships are such a big part of my work. You know, mm-hmm. Maybe when I was a little younger, things were different. You're so locked in on the writing and the editing, the reporting. For me now, a book is a three-part process. It's the relationships, it's the research, and then it's the writing. And at this point, I enjoy the relationships and the research a lot more than I do the writing. So to be able to have a friend like Carl and a friend like Alex, and now to bring them together, that's just such a great joy in life when you can bring two great people together. And it's kind of funny now to watch Carl cheering for him. He's gone to some of the Astros games with me to watch Bregman play, and that's been a lot of fun. Mm-hmm.
And amid all this, Jeffrey has become perhaps the foremost advocate for organ donation, and this is something very personal for you.
Well, it is very personal for me. Certainly not the foremost advocate, but it's been something that's a huge part of my life. Since my little sister, Wendy, needed a liver transplant, she had one in 1989. And her life was extended by 14 years. Unfortunately, she died in 2003 at the age of 36. She was in need of a liver transplant again because of the hepatitis B virus, this uninvited poison that had never left her body. So I miss Wendy every day. She's with me every day. But I keep working on her issue. Her issue was to do whatever we could to reach as many people as we can about the desperate need for organ donors in this nation. So Carl is very involved in that as well. Carl and Wendy and I formed a foundation, and now Carl and I do it together in Wendy's name.
Well, it's something that I think many of us take for granted. You were affected personally by this, but it's not a hard thing to do to be an organ donor, is it?
Well, I'm not encouraging anyone to get to that final step, which is if you are a cadaver donor, I'm not suggesting that anyone, you know, rush toward that. But it's a great idea to plan for it. It's a great idea to think about it, learn about it. Most importantly, talk about it. Talk about it to your family, to your loved ones, let your friends know, and then register. You know, now it's so much easier than it was early on when we got involved in this in 1989. It's so much easier to register now and have that on the record so that people know, so that the authorities know when the time comes that that's something you want to do.
Now, you won your Pulitzer when you were covering the University of Kentucky basketball program, which is like Alabama football. It is the gold standard as far as excellence. Now, they ran into some problems, and that's why Jeffrey won the Pulitzer for his reporting. But you've been to all these places. You've chosen to live in Baton Rouge. And as we know, sports is rather dominant here, and particularly LSU sports. How is LSU compared to other places you've been as far as the fan support and just the rabid nature of the culture surrounding LSU athletics?
Yeah, in terms of culture of the athletics, I've always compared it since I've been here. I've seen that comparison between LSU football and Kentucky basketball in terms of the passion, in terms of the way people are involved and follow it as closely as they do. I would say of the other places I've lived, none of them can compare to those. Now, there's so many others around the country that I haven't actually lived there to experience them, but I'd have a tough time believing that there's a whole lot that would surpass the passion, the excitement, the impact on the local culture and environment that LSU football has, LSU sports in general, really, and then Kentucky basketball, as you said. The thing here, and I noticed this when I was working on the book, I really feel like all roads in Baton Rouge in one way or another lead through the world of LSU sports. And at first I was thinking of that half jokingly, but I came to realize it's really true, whether it's economically, whether it's in terms of cultural enjoyment, what people do for social gatherings, a lot of it revolves around the world of LSU sports in one way or another.
And I have a feeling that Alex Bregman will be quite an ambassador along the way.
Absolutely. That guy, you talk about a guy that loves LSU sports. During the football season, he's all over the LSU football stuff. Of course, he stays very closely attached to the baseball program, but it's much broader for him. This place is very special for him. He loves it, and I have a feeling he'll always be closely connected to LSU.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey Marks, Pulitzer Prize-winning sports writer who lives right here in our midst in Baton Rouge. And we're back with Robert Merry, the historian. His book is President McKinley. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Ali Baltazar is producing, and your numbers again, 297-5633 locally and outside the Baton Rouge area, 877-217-5757. We're joined by Robert W. Merry. He's the author of Where They Stand, A Country of Vast Designs, James K. Polk, Sands of Empire, and Taking on the World, a longtime Washington journalist, commentator, and publishing executive. He covered government and politics for the Wall Street Journal for a decade and spent 22 years as an executive at Congressional Quarterly, including 12 years as CEO. His work is President McKinley, Architect of the American Century, fresh off the press from Simon & Schuster, and it is a story about the 25th occupant of the White House, a man who had a rich life that was cut short. Good morning to you, Robert Merry.
Good morning to you. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's nice to talk with you. And you say he was the architect of the American century, meaning the 20th century. He was the president leading up to the 20th century. Why was he significant to what happened for the remaining 100 years?
Well, I have to say that my subtitle there is somewhat provocative in the sense that McKinley is not generally viewed as a seminal president, but I view him as such, and I think previous biographers, there hasn't been a major biography of McKinley since 1959 with Margaret Leach and her wonderful book, In the Days of McKinley. My argument is that he was, in fact, a pivotal president because he transformed the presidency and how it operated vis-a-vis Congress, vis-a-vis the media, vis-a-vis the American people. He made America, turned America into an empire with the Spanish-American War. He acquired Hawaii through negotiation. He acquired the Philippines, Guam, and Puerto Rico through war negotiations. He established the special relationship with Great Britain just a few years before. We were in a very hostile relationship with the Brits. He pushed towards the Panama Canal, which later came about through Roosevelt, but it was McKinley who reversed his predecessor's actions in terms of not being interested in the canal. So all those things sort of wrap up into a president of consequence. And I don't think that he's been getting credit for how consequential he was, and I set out to reverse that.
He was an amiable governor of Ohio, and of course his vice president was a famous man who became more famous than William McKinley. What were the circumstances behind Teddy Roosevelt and when William McKinley coming together?
Well, the two men could not have been more different. Teddy was impetuous and always on the move and bustling and a man of action and a man who was consumed with himself. McKinley was a man who had been taught from very, very early age not to brag, not to boast, to be modest. And he was a man who operated sort of from the shadows, from the edges of things. As a manager, he was incrementalist, whereas T.R. was a man of action and boldness and brashness. His own kids said that he had an almost desperate desire to be the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral. He had to be at the center of everything. And McKinley didn't care who got the credit for anything as long as he got his way. And it turns out, if you study carefully how he operated, he did always get his way. And he did it by sort of manipulating people into doing the things he wanted while thinking that it was their idea. So it was very clever, but very, very different from T.R. And I argue that the T.R. biographers, in order to elevate Teddy Roosevelt as the man who really moved America into the 20th century, had to diminish McKinley's standing in history in order to push that vision. And I think it's a faulty vision, or shall I say incomplete vision.
And he was a young man when he was assassinated.
I think he was 58 at the time. 58.
58 years old. What were the circumstances behind his killing?
Well, he went to the famous Pan-American Exposition in Buffalo, New York, what today would be called the World's Fair. He had a tendency to, he loved talking to the American people. He loved to be in receiving lines. He had a way of shaking hands in an agreeable manner, but very quickly, so he could shake hands with like 50 people in a minute. He had to be very, very efficient at it. And his advisors were telling him, "Mr. President, you really shouldn't do this. This is dangerous." And he refused to believe that anybody would want to hurt him personally or harm the American Republic by harming the president. So he was in a receiving line at this exposition, having made a major speech the day before, and a anarchist by the name of Leon Czolgosz, with his hand with a pistol kind of in a bandage, like it was in a sling, to conceal the weapon, walked right up to him, put the gun right into his chest, and fired. That bullet did not really penetrate significantly. It wouldn't have harmed him. But he went back on his heels. Czolgosz fired again. The bullet entered his abdomen, and he died 2 weeks later as a result of infections.
His death has been compared to that of Huey Long, the Louisiana governor, who died, of course, a few days after he was shot. Both died in September, McKinley in 1901. You describe him as a man short of stature, broad of shoulder, with luminescent gray-blue eyes and a ready smile.
Interesting thing about McKinley was, notwithstanding his somewhat quiet ways, it was a heavy quiet that had a kind of commanding quality. People gravitated to him. He was a war hero in the Civil War as a very young man. He entered the war as a private, 18-year-old private. He ended the war as a 22-year-old brevet major. And his promotions, most of them, came as a result of battlefield heroics, including at Antietam, the bloodiest day of American history. And then he got a law degree, went to Canton, Ohio, where his sister had been teaching school, and he was a joiner. He joined the Chamber of Commerce, a local church, various veterans organizations, and almost everywhere he joined, he was asked and promoted into leadership positions. So people gravitated to him and liked him, and older men took him under their wing and became mentors to him. So he had a presence, but it wasn't a raucous presence of the nature of Teddy Roosevelt. I will say to your listeners that Teddy Roosevelt, while I have a great admiration for T.R., and I praise him in my book on the American Presidency, Where They Stand, but he serves as kind of comic relief in my narrative because he was so constantly out of control and impetuous and sometimes in rather comical ways.
The book is President McKinley, Architect of the American Century. He died in 1901, September 14, and Teddy Roosevelt became the president. Robert Mary reports with perhaps definitive words about the union between McKinley and Roosevelt. Was Teddy Roosevelt ready for the job at the time?
Oh, I don't think there was any question he was ready. Teddy Roosevelt, me, along with Lincoln, I think probably were the two most brilliant, two pure geniuses who became president. What Roosevelt could do with that mind of his was truly amazing in terms of writing books in very short order, very, very penetrating books, in terms of understanding things, in terms of pushing things, knowing how to push events in the desired direction. And he did it, as I say, in a very raucous and very bold manner. He was prepared to be president. But when he was Assistant Navy Secretary, and McKinley was a little reluctant to give him that position when McKinley first became president, and Roosevelt's friends, including many, many prominent friends, were pushing him for this job, and he desperately wanted it. And McKinley was afraid that he would be just a little bit too likely to get into spats with people, et cetera. And he suggested that to one mutual friend. And they said, no, he won't be a problem. Well, he became the Assistant Navy Secretary under a guy named John Long from Massachusetts. And Long ultimately felt like he couldn't take an afternoon off because he wasn't sure what TR was going to do with the power that he would hold on that temporary basis. So that was the nature of TR. So temperamentally, you could raise some questions about whether he was prepared. But in terms of his intellect, in terms of what he knew about the country and where he wanted to take it, there was no question.
The book is President McKinley, and we have about 30 seconds to go with this fine gentleman, Robert Mary. What about his wife? He was very concerned about her at the time he was dying.
She was infirm. She was described as an invalid, and in some ways she was. She had a whole series of maladies that interacted to make her physically impaired and also kind of psychologically brittle. And this was not the woman he had married. He had married someone who was almost scintillating and clever and sparkling. And yet he never wavered in his devotion to her and his love for her. And that was really quite a poignant story.
Well, thank you for joining us. Robert W. Mary, the book is President McKinley, Architect of the American Century. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.